You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is Walk the Talk with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. In these podcasts, I will be talking with people who share their stories of tragedy and hope. I will be exploring mental health and well-being with workplace professionals and also with folk who have struggled to make sense of their own lives. My hope is that these shared experiences will remove the loneliness from those people who are convinced it is their fate to suffer alone. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been a serving police officer for over 20 years. You're very welcome to join me on Walk the Talk. Tony White is a freelance mental health consultant with 20 years' experience of high-functioning depression, anxiety and complex PTSD. Specialising in men's and workplace mental health, Tony's work centres around education and advocation of men's mental health and vulnerability, mentoring and supporting men on a one-to-one level, as well as talks and training on the topic, using a direct but humorous approach, offering realistic advice and solutions. She's been credited with changing people's attitudes towards mental health, getting men to seek help and treatment for their own mental health. She's currently advising Devon and Cornwall Police on the mental health of frontline officers and is co-writing a piece with a police superintendent on the topic of men's mental health in policing. So join us now as we discuss the complex topic of men's mental health along the banks of the River Ex in Devon on a beautiful sunny morning. Tony, welcome to Walk the Talk.
Thank you, good morning.
There'll be many listening to this who may be asking why, as a woman, do you feel able to quantify men's mental health?
Oh, that's a potentially controversial question. The answer is I don't. There's nothing about me as a woman that makes it any better or worse to advocate for men. It's simply I fell into it because when I was working as a secretary at a law firm, like the police, very male-dominated sector, ended up mentoring a lot of men. And I was already beginning to self-study about men's mental health, why it was such an issue, why men weren't coming forward, why suicide 75% is men. So it just kind of fell into it, and I spend my evenings researching, reading reports, dissertations from around the world to further my knowledge, but there's nothing about me being a woman that makes it any better or worse. I know some great men's mental health advocates that are men. It just so happens that I'm a woman.
Okay, well, I suppose that does bring us on to the fact, though, that we ask, why is mental health or men's mental health different to women's?
It's a lot of it will be founded in traditional masculinity, so the societal expectations of men to be stoic, physically, mentally, emotionally strong, independent, that kind of father of the pride, as it were. And a lot of those mean that we sit on our emotions as men, so we downplay them, we don't analyze them, we stuff them in Pandora's box, and the problem with that is that Pandora's box will open at the most inconvenient times because it can only hold so much crisis. And we know that, I think there was a recent study that said 34% of men spend 2 years in crisis before they even consider help. So it is different. We don't often give men the language that's needed to say help. So men are disadvantaged by the education system as boys and then further institutionalized into those macho, masculine dominated roles. So we can't ask them to say help if we're not first giving them the emotive language that they need to articulate their thoughts and feelings, specifically to say, this is what's wrong with me. So a lot of men that I work with will say, something's wrong with me, or I don't feel right, but they don't have that specific language. It's like if you say to a woman, why you're angry, and they say, oh, I'm really disappointed, or I'm frustrated, or I feel rejected. But if you say to a man, why are you angry, you will inherently get many versions of I'm angry.
Uh-huh.
Because we don't give them the language and the tools. We don't teach them to be introspective like girls. And girls, again, by the education system, we're taught to be introspective, the writers, the thinkers, the feelers, the empaths, which is inherently against what we view as traditional masculinity. Men inherently don't have the emotional support networks that women do. So, for example, if we have a relationship breakdown, we've got everyone from colleagues to hairdressers to to tell, you know, woe is me. But what happens with men is that they don't simply have those support networks. They might have, certainly in the police, you'll have mates on your team. You might have a couple of colleagues that you'll see outside of work. You might even play five-a-side football. And you've got those emotional support networks, but they're still fairly superficial. You can say, oh yeah, you know, had a really bad date the other night or something like that, but it will take a lot more to get them to admit that their marriage is breaking down. So again, they don't have the emotional support networks, which is why a lot of the time relationship breakdowns can have catastrophic consequences for men over women. So we know that divorce increases the rate of suicide in men, as does loss of job or finances. Any sense of control that a man feels that they've lost has a lot more devastating consequences for them than it does for women, simply because they don't have their tribe behind them, as it were.
I mean, do you think men are more superficial than women?
No, not at all. I speak to a great many men that are highly emotionally intelligent. They're thinkers, intellects. They read incredible books, which on topics that I have no idea about. But I think it does feed into that traditional masculinity culture that we have. The men are supposed to be the lads that love the football, love the women. And so what happens is you create that in society, so that even men that don't feel that they align themselves to those views of traditional masculinity will often step up to that to get along in the culture. If we look at policing culture, which is typically masculine, for example, you'll have a lot of women that may come in which will take on masculine traits and mindsets to get on in that culture. And that's no different for men. So it's not that men are any more or less superficial, but again, in society, there's that expectation of them to be.
Well, a lot of the problem is that men are unwilling to speak. I mean, I remember several years ago that I sought some therapy from the death of my own mother, and I found it difficult to talk and spent most of the time sitting in silence as the onus was put on me to talk. And it really didn't work, to be honest with you. So how do you think you will get folk to open up to you?
It's about placing the onus on the person that has received that call for help. So when you ask for help, so for example, when you turn up to therapy, you've done the hardest part. The reason why I'm able to get many people, but particularly men, to open up to me is because I lead with vulnerability. So I disarm them. And when they say help, I often, particularly with men, they want directive therapy. So they want to fix themselves, particularly in police, because you are fixers to society. You go, you see a problem, you're called to help, and you fix that situation. And so again, that's what I see with people that come to me. They want to understand why they're feeling that way or what they can do to fix it. And a lot of the time it's, I need help, but I don't really know how I'm struggling. I just know that I feel off. And then it's my job to ask them non-critical questions to further understand why they might be feeling the way that they do. Was it a particular situation or relationship that's broken down? But help is the hardest thing that you'll have to say. And so once they've done that, it's my job then to coax it out of them. And that sometimes takes weeks. It's continually showing up. It's continually checking in with them, asking if they want to talk. And sometimes that will take weeks, if not months. And other people might say, you know, you're not getting anywhere. And then all of a sudden I'll get a message back and it'll be, I'm feeling this way. And it'll just be one sentence. But what happens when you have that truth is you have to validate it. You have to acknowledge that they have asked you for help in whatever way that it is. And so the onus is now on you. It's a bit like a mental health relay, if you were. They've passed the baton to you. It's your job now to check for signposting, ask them what the situation is. If it's marriage related, are there any local counselling therapies that they may consider? It's very exhausting to ask for help. And what we do is we downplay it because we fear that people won't validate our vulnerability, that we'll scare them off. So, for example, if an officer's talking to me and he's talking about hierarchy or terminology or is using acronyms, if you're talking to someone outside of the organisation, for example, if you're calling Samaritans, they will have no idea what you're talking about. And my premise is that you've asked for help, you've done the hardest part, you've shown up, and it's exhausting. So I don't ask people to educate me. I go away and I educate myself. So if somebody's throwing OIC out or TPAC and I don't know what they're talking about, I don't interrupt them to say, can you explain what that is, please? Or can you explain the rank? It's my job to educate myself because they've done the hardest part.
Yeah, and it's important. And what you've hit on is listening, isn't it? And to interrupt somebody whilst they're sharing something with you can be detrimental to them getting it out, I suppose.
Certainly when they're talking about feelings. I mean, if you're talking about breakfast choices, then that's something different. But if somebody's talking about feelings and then you're coming in with a very logical question, it throws them off. And they've psyched themselves up so much and they'll feel so anxious and they're so ready to finally talk, that if you don't give them that space, if you don't know how to hold that space, if you don't know how to actively listen, you have the potential to lose them if they feel like they're being criticised or judged in any way. So it's extremely delicate, and I think a lot of people don't understand that level of vulnerability and the power that can hold if we validate or dismiss it.
Well, I was thinking when I knew I'd be interviewing you today is whether men are better at hiding their mental health from others, and I suppose the bottom line is, are they better liars?
Oh, that's an extremely controversial question. I think, again, it comes back to that fear and that societal expectation that they do have to be the strong ones. And a lot of that, you know, it's very easy for us to say men need to speak up. But what I find a lot of the time, and with anybody's mental health, be it a female officer or a male, is that level of shame. And we know on a logical level, it's not shameful to be struggling with the job or to have poor mental health or be mentally ill, but it doesn't stop it feeling shameful. And so what I do is help them realise that they can still talk about their shame, and it doesn't make me judge or criticise them. But I think for men, it's that ultimate fear that they will be ridiculed and shamed in that manhood, if you like, that prevents many from speaking up. And so we have to make it less shameful. And for those that don't understand that concept, it's people that don't understand the power of shame. And let's face it, you know, shame and vulnerability has the potential, you know, we kill ourselves and each other to protect those. So until you appreciate what that level of shame can do to someone, you will never be able to coax it out of them.
Well, I suppose what you're saying is that men have to be stoic, but what's causing them to think that they have to be?
I think, again, it comes back to this expectation that men are the leaders of the world. They, you know, and you don't get to be in these positions if you have feelings or if you talk about them. We're still in that mindset of having a dragon boss, that you have to be a dictator to be a good leader. And actually, to be a good leader, you need incredible soft skills. But many won't appreciate that. And so because we continue both passively and directly this expectation of men to be decisive, to be controlling, to be powerful, none of those will allow the space to be emotive or empathetic or compassionate. And so they stick it in a box because they are seen as inherently female traits, feminine qualities. And as I said, whilst many female officers may take on masculine qualities to be in that culture, be it a law firm or whatever masculine-dominated culture it is, many men still won't accept the, quote, feminine cultures, the feminine qualities that we have, that would help them do their job better. But again, in society, women are still seen as the weak, emotional women that can't control their feelings. So we're not going to get men openly trying to take on feminine qualities, despite how much it would benefit them.
So, I mean, are we saying that women are part of the problem then?
No, I think there is a definite difference between feminine and masculine. And what we're not doing is teaching men. So particularly in the moment where we have this culture of denouncing toxic masculinity, that's fine, but we're also not promoting the positive aspects of masculinity. So we're not saying that, yes, in some instances, the command and control approach isn't going to work. However, in some, that's absolutely needed. And that masculine trait is a positive aspect. So it isn't that women are the problem, it's that society has institutionalized us both to be these separate masculine and feminine traits. And certainly what you find, and I find, because I have many traits of both sides, that actually it means that I'm able to speak to both. But so many of us live in tick boxes and pigeonholes that it's very difficult to step outside of them when a culture, be it society or a work culture, won't allow that.
And I suppose that's what, very clumsily, I was trying to say, is that society has made men and women the way they should be, I suppose, in society's eyes. And I'm just wondering how that's come about.
Oh, years and years of, you know, if we look at how the police started, for example, when they advertised for police officers, they asked for men that weren't of noble standing. You know, they wanted men to have that gruff kind of disciplinarian, that tough exterior. They wanted someone to come in and physically fight people if needed.
Right.
And I think certainly within the policing culture, that testosterone comes out and that anger. We think, oh, men are angry, and so we have this macho culture. And then it's just years and years and years of our culture and society. And so if we look at China, for example, with the one child system, and if they're born as a girl, you know, we've heard of horrific stories where they're left, or, you know, because they value men above everything else. So it's not just Western society inherently throughout, you know, millennium. If we look at some of the most powerful leaders, they're men. And so it's a very, very slow process, and we won't see it in our lifetime, the change. It is slowly happening. And certainly I see it in younger generations and younger officers. They're a lot more self-aware and introspective about their emotions, and they're quite happy to talk about them and share about them. But obviously we've still got a major issue in society, because suicide is still the biggest killer of men under 50. And it's not young men. It's the midlife men.
Mm.
It's men between 42 and 49 who have the highest suicide rates. So as much as we've spent years joking about the midlife crisis, that is actually the midlife crisis is true, and it isn't Porsches and young women. It's men losing their identities.
Well, I was going to ask you, the midlife crisis, middle-aged men, highest suicide rates. What sort of problems are there surrounding that?
So it all leads into each other, but inherently what you have, and again, if we look at policing, is that they will have a career stall at that age. So they've come up through the ranks, perhaps. They may, because of the years in the policing, poor shift patterns, council rest days, etc. Their marriage may be suffering. Their kids are older, so they're all going off, so they've got empty nest syndrome. And so suddenly they find themselves as, well, am I just a leading rank? Because my wife's not really talking to me, so I'm not a husband, my kids have gone to university or off. So there's this real identity crisis of the midlife crisis. And we often find that men of that age will be living alone. As I said, that they'll have strained or distant relationships to their children and perhaps wider family members. And so all these lead into loneliness. And we know how loneliness can affect a society, and that's increased our mental illness rates. But all that will impact on physical health. So if we're not giving them the tools, whether that be therapy, self-awareness, exercise, healthy eating, if we're not giving all these tools and advice to try and counteract it, then we will keep losing midlife men.
Well, my experience with the police service, and it might not be typical, but certainly a lot of people find partners within the job. And a lot of police officers keep their circle of friends within the job as well. So if the job starts to suffer, then it's natural to assume that friends and family will also suffer for that very reason.
Absolutely, yes. And this is the problem that we have when certainly there's a presentation of mental illness at work, and we're faced with many senior leaders with the, you know, take it or leave it attitude. And my argument to that is, how can you leave your identity? Because that is the identity for many people, as you said, whether it's because they've got family members in the job or friends. Their entire life is built around the police. When we don't value that kind of sacrifice, if you like, and we face them with the take it or leave it or attitude, you're actually asking them to give up their entire identity, which is why retired officers, they will have a huge dip in their mental health just after retirement. For whatever reason that they do retire.
Well, I think one of the reasons is what I've said, is that they leave the police service and their friends are in the service and they retire, and it's almost as if they retire from their friends as well, because they don't have a circle outside of that job.
Absolutely. Their entire identity is surrounded by the police, both directly and indirectly. So once they leave, you know, there's feelings of isolation, that they feel forgotten, that they don't know how to be themselves outside of the police. So it isn't just what they say goodbye and we leave them. We have to help them once they leave, and we have to help them grieve for their identity and the life that they've left behind, and then help them to create a new one.
Well, we're sort of halfway through now. We're coming up to a lovely pub by the Keys. What's the pub called?
Double Locks.
Okay, you've been here before?
I have, many times. It's a local secret, so don't tell anyone.
Well, you're okay. It's radio, this, so they won't be able to see it. Adverse childhood experiences can emotionally stunt victims, whether you're a man or a woman, effectively having to deal with adult problems later on in life with the mind and emotional outlook of a child. Have you found men are more susceptible to early years trauma?
It comes back to a lot of feelings of shame and guilt. And again, we know that shame is a huge factor in why many men don't discuss things in their past. And so it isn't the fact that they're more susceptible necessarily, but it's more the consequence. And so we then teach these boys to grow up as men, to be more prone to risk-taking behaviour, which is often self-destructive. So it will be alcohol, drugs, promiscuity, all these kind of things, which are coping mechanisms. And they are absolutely vital to that person being to coping and remaining functional in society. But we don't look to understand why they're self-destructing. We don't give them the opportunity and that space to poke the hornet's nest, as it were, and ask them where this behaviour's come from. So it isn't that they're more susceptible to adverse childhood experiences, but how we help them deal with them, acknowledge them and unpack those emotions, I think, does detrimentally affect men.
Well, I suppose we are where we are with all this. So what can men and women do, I suppose, to change these barriers and break down the stigmas of mental health?
I think really when it comes to men supporting other men, I use my work as I lead by vulnerability. So I always talk about my struggles with mental illness and what I've been through, because it's disarming. It allows other people to recognise it's a safe zone, that if I'm talking about it, they can too. So it really is this question of, I know that we talk about saying we have to create these cultures where talking is more acceptable and encouraged. It really is that. We need lived experience leadership. So we need inspectors, chief constables to come out and say, you know, I had a really dark time, I did this, my family was really supportive. We need those positive messages continually fed through. And obviously, the greater the rank, the better sort of impact it will have, if you like. But we need to, at team level, service level, create those tiny cultures of authenticity where we can come in and we might just say, oh, I slept really terribly last night and I woke up with a really bad back. And you'd be like, oh, I slept terribly last night, lots of nightmares, feel a bit tearful today. That's it. doesn't mean that all of a sudden they need a risk assessment for their mental health. It just means casually dropping it into a conversation and normalising it. And what we do by that is the ripple effect. So you have that first person who sacrifices their vulnerability to say, I'm having a really difficult day. That next person goes, oh, hang on a minute. They're still standing. They're vulnerable. They're openly talking, maybe I can. And so it really is a ripple effect that you can have. And we usually have that at team level. We have very tight-knit teams that work as mini families. So it's really is about changing that stigma and culture at family level and then taking that and replicating it through the ranks.
And you're right, it is leading by example. As you quite rightly say, if somebody shared an experience that was perhaps a peer, a lot of the obvious response to that is, well, I don't want to work with this person, they're seen as weak. But if it comes from somebody higher up, then there's perhaps a less inclination to think that.
Absolutely, and the onus isn't... So, for example, you said there, you know, somebody might say, well, I don't want to work with them. The onus, therefore, is not on the person who is unwell. The onus from a senior leadership level is to confront... I say confront, that's a strong word, but the onus is then to speak to that person who's got the attitude issue about mental ill health.
You've been very public about the trauma you've suffered after being the victim of rape, and indeed you continue to suffer. Now, I know the police continue to investigate the matter, but perhaps you could share how it affected your own mental health.
So for me, my rape came at the end of about 8 or 9 months of coercive abuse by my boss. And it took me a long time to face that trauma. It wasn't until I lost my job that I really started to begin to face just how much he had got into my head, and he broke me. He and my male managers, who said it was my own fault for drinking, they absolutely destroyed my sense of self. I lost a lot in my life, colleagues that I considered friends. It really has. It's one of those crimes, I think, where the consequences are endless at times, and they're relentless. And every time that you think you have faced another trigger and that you've dealt with it, another one will hit you like a freight train when you least expect it. So for me, I'm one of the most strongest, resilient women that most people have met because of everything I've been through in my life. But my sense of self became extremely eroded, and I spend a lot of my days feeling incredibly worthless. And which is, it's polar opposite to the work that I'm doing with police, how I could command a room full of men and still feel worthless. But again, it comes back to that, you know, feelings aren't always logical. So it really has been a case of having a do in my life. And actually, my relationships with men have become incredibly complicated, whether it's professional, personal, platonic. Everything changes, your whole sense of self. And I can never be the woman I was before that night. So there has been that sense of grieving for that woman. But my advocation for men's mental health is probably what saved me, because I already had fantastic men in my life. I've met many more incredible men now that I've come into the policing sphere. And forming those relationships with men are extremely reparative and nurturing, which is complete counterbalance to what I've been through.
Well, we've talked a lot about time today, a time to heal and a time to recover. So, Tony, thank you very much for your time today.